The subject of today's study is two kinds of truth. Every teaching or every religion is concerned with truth. And then people say there is only one truth, and people call it or interpret it in different ways. But I don't know whether that is really true. So logically, there should be only one truth. But I think truth varies according to different people or different religions, different teachers. So when we ask a Christian about truth, we will get one answer, and if you ask a Buddhist, you get another answer. So now, Abhidhamma is also concerned with truth. And in Abhidhamma, or in the teachings of the Buddha, truth means just reality, or something that is true, something that is real, either on conventional level or ultimate level. Anything which is true is called truth. So truth is, truth need not be lofty, or truth need not be good according to Buddhism. When we say there is attachment, then it is there, attachment is there, and we experience attachment, or we experience greed in our minds. And so attachment or greed is called a truth in Buddha's teachings. And also mindfulness. We practice meditation and we practice mindfulness. And mindfulness is also a thing we call truth, because it is, and it is not otherwise. So, in Buddhism, truth means just something which is true. It may be true on conventional level, or it may be true on ultimate level. But both, that is true on conventional level and ultimate level, are called truth in Buddha's teachings. So wisdom also, thank you, is truth. So everything we see or we find or we experience is a kind of truth. And I think you may have heard, or you have really known or read about the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism. So according to Buddhism, there is not one truth, but four kinds of truth. But here in Abhidhamma, we'll come to the Four Noble Truths later, towards the end of the lecture. So here we are concerned with two kinds of truth in Buddhism. So Buddhism accepted or recognized truth on conventional level and truth on ultimate level. So two kinds of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth. And conventional truth is that which conforms to the convention or usage of the world, usage of the people. That means when these words were created for the first time, people maybe they got together and then they agreed to call a certain thing, say a table or a desk, or here I give the car as an example. So it is by the agreement of the people that a certain thing is called a desk, a table, or a car. And that is accepted by all people. And so when you say the word a table, a desk, or a car, people understand you. So that is what we call conventional truth, true according to the usage of the people. When I ask you, what did you come in to this class, so you will say, I came in a car. So when you say you came in a car, you are telling the truth, because you really came in a car, and unless you live close to this place and walk up here. So the name or the word a car, or even the thing denoted by the word car, is what we call conventional truth. It is true on the conventional level. And conventional truth is called Sammuti Satya in Pali. Sammuti means convention or agreement of the people, and Satya means truth. And it is sometimes called apparent truth because it appears as truth, but in the ultimate analysis, it is not. And conventional truth is also called Panyati in Pali. So there should be tildes above the ends. You have two ends there, P-A-N-N-A-T-T-I. So they should be like in Spanish, I call that like in the word señor, Panyati, or concept. So conventional truth is called Panyati, or concept. And the Panyati is of two kinds, Nama Panyati and Atta Panyati. Now, Panyati, the word Panyati has two meanings, active meaning and passive meaning. And there is causal meaning inherent in the word. So in the active sense, Panyati means that which makes known, that which makes things known. And in the passive sense, Panyati means that which is made known. Now, we give names to things. We call a certain thing a car, a house, a table, a desk, and also living beings, a man, a woman. Now, these names we give to the objects are called Nama Panyati, or name, I call it name concept. It is just names given to the objects by which we refer to the things. So they are called name concept or Nama Panyati. Name concept because the names make things known. When I say a car, you know what it is. When I say a desk, you know what it is. So the words make things known to people, things known to those who whom we are speaking with. So the names given to the objects are called Nama Panyati, or name concept. This is one kind of conventional truth. And the other is called Atta Panyati. And I call it thing concept. That is something which is made known by the names, which is the objects conveyed by the names or concepts, or the real thing. So, for example, a car. The name a car is Nama Panyati. And the thing which is the car is Atta Panyati, or thing concept. So when I say a man, the name or the noun a man is name concept, and the real person who is the man is thing concept. So we can have this pair of Panyati for almost everything. Name concept and thing concept. Even with regard to the ultimate things, there can be name concept. Because when we say consciousness, the name consciousness is Nama Panyati. But the consciousness, the real thing denoted by the word consciousness is ultimate truth. So we don't call that concept, but that is truth. So there are two kinds of conventional truth or panyati, and they are nama panyati, name concept, and artha panyati, thing concept. So we use words every day, and we denote things by these words. So things denoted by the words are called thing concept, and the names themselves are name concepts. So there can be many kinds of name concepts and many kinds of thing concepts in the world. And they all belong to, here they belong to a conventional truth. And the conventional truth or panyati, especially nama panyati, is said to be, said to belong to no time. We cannot say that the concept is present or past or future, because it has no existence of its own, actually. When we give a name to a person, the name seems to be created, or the name seems to come into being for the first time. But we do not actually know when the name comes into being, because the name may have been in the world long ago, and then somebody pick up that name and give to a person. And this name will go on and on even after the person dies. And then so long as the people remember the name, then this name will be in their minds or used by people. And sometimes people will forget the names, and the names seem to disappear from the world. But later, maybe some centuries later or some world cycles later, a person may be reborn, and he may pick up that name and use that name, and so it seems to come into being again. So the nama panyati or panyati concept is said to be timeless. We cannot say it is present or it is past or it is future. So if you know, Buddha was a bodhisattva for many millions of lives. So when he first took the vows of bodhisattva, or when he first got the declaration that he would become the Buddha, his name was Sumedha. And that name was remembered by people maybe for some time. And then that name disappeared, and maybe many world cycles it was forgotten. And then he became the Buddha at last, and became Gautama Buddha. And then the Buddha related this story of his first becoming a bodhisattva. And then the name Sumedha appears again. So name or the concept is said to be timeless in Abhidhamma. And there are different kinds of panyati, different kinds of conventional truth treated in the 8th chapter of the Manual of Abhidhamma. The important ones are those related to the real existent things and those related to non-existent things. And here existent means that which really exists, that which really has the three moments of existence, coming into being, staying for some time, and disappearing. These three moments are called moments of existence. Those which have this existence, real existence, are called existent things. And the panyati, which do not exist on their own, but which may exist only in the minds of the people, are called non-existent. So some panyadis are based on the existent things and some on non-existent things. Now, existent things means those that belong to ultimate reality, like consciousness, mental factors, mindfulness, wisdom, and others. And those that are said to be non-existent are like man, a woman, a table, chair, all these things. They seem to be existing, but in ultimate reality, they don't exist at all. What exists is just the particles of material properties, and also with regard to living beings, just mind and matter. So you can read about these different kinds of concepts in the last section of the 8th chapter. Now the next is the ultimate truth, and it is more important for us who are studying Abhidhamma, because Abhidhamma deals with ultimate truth. And the ultimate truth is that which conforms to reality on ultimate level. Ultimate truth is sometimes called abstract truth. So in the manual, the word abstract is used. It is something like which is taken out of the conventional truth, or squeezed out of conventional truth. For example, we say a man. So a man is a conventional truth. According to the ultimate analysis, there is no one we can call a man. A man or a woman is just the combination of mind and matter, or a combination of five aggregates. So ultimate truth is what we extract or abstract from the conventional truth. But first we see a man or a woman, and we extract mind and matter from it and say, this is not a man, this is not a woman, but this is a combination of mind and matter. So mind and matter, it seems taken out of the conventional truth. I mean, conventional truth, yes, which is a man or a woman. So ultimate truth is sometimes called abstract truth. And ultimate truth is called in Pali Paramattha Satya. Paramattha Satya is the literal meaning of Paramattha Satya is the good or correct thing which is truth. So Paramattha means a good or correct thing. Now, why is something called a good thing or a correct thing? So there are two reasons for this. And one is because it is real as it is. It exists. It is there. And it is not otherwise than is stated. When we say there is, like say, craving, there really is craving. When we say there is mindfulness, there really is mindfulness. So we can experience mindfulness. And it is not like things at magic shows or mirrors. Things that are shown at magic shows are not real. They are made to seem real, but they are not real. And the same with the mirrors. So when we see mirrors from a distance, we see it is water. But when we get closer to the place, then it disappears and there is no water at all. So things at magic shows or mirrors or other things are otherwise than is stated. See, that means when you see a mirror, you may say, oh, there's water there. But actually, there is no water. So it is otherwise than is stated. Water is not water, something like that. But the ultimate truth is opposite of that. So it really is, it really exists, it really can be experienced. So the second reason for it being good or a correct thing is that it can be seen by oneself, it can be realized by oneself, it can be experienced by oneself. We can experience craving, we can experience anger, we can experience mindfulness and wisdom and so on. And so these can be experienced by us, by ourselves. And so they are called ultimate truth. So it may also imply that until you really experience them, until you have a experiential knowledge of them, they will not become paramatta for you. It may be ultimate truth in the books, but until you experience yourself, especially through meditation, they may not be ultimate truth for you. So ultimate truth is that which can be seen by oneself, which can be experienced by oneself. So it is an object of direct knowledge, not like things known from hearsay, because things known from hearsay may be true or may not be true. We never know. So ultimate truth is not like things known from hearsay. Ultimate truth is the real thing which we experience and which we know for ourselves, and so there can be no doubt about them. So that is called ultimate truth. So there are two kinds of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth, taught, recognized in Buddhism. And Abhidhamma deals with the ultimate truth. Very little with conventional truth. I say very little because among the seven books of Abhidhamma, there is one book called Designation of Human Types. And that book, although it is included in the Abhidhamma Pitaka, it looks like a Sutta discourse, because there are different types of individuals are mentioned. Now, there are eight types of individuals, or nine types of individuals, ten types of individuals, from one to ten, something like that. So in that book, the terms used are also of conventional truth, not the Abhidhamma terms themselves. So with the exception of that book, Abhidhamma deals with the real, the ultimate truth, which are the five aggregates, or 12 bases, 18 elements, or in brief, consciousness, mental factors, and so on. So you will not find any words denoting a person or a man or a woman, but you will find words denoting aggregates or bases or elements and so on. So Abhidhamma Pitaka deals with the ultimate truth. So it is different from these, very different from Sutta Pitaka, and it is not easy to understand without first getting the fundamental knowledge of it. That is why Abhidhamma books are difficult to understand, because you need a fundamental knowledge of Abhidhamma in order to read books on the real books on Abhidhamma. not a book like this, the manual. This manual can be read by any person, and I hope they will not find it too difficult. But the real Abhidhamma books, like the Dhammasangani or Vibhanga, may seem some foreign language.
Well, this chart.
This chart too? No, it will become very clear. But, you know, I didn't put any what you call, explanations on the chart because I want it to be something like a mystery. So when people look at it and say, oh, what is this? It is better this way. So that you get acquainted with it very quickly. Because when there are names written on it and people don't try to memorize it or try to know it thoroughly, because there are names written on it and you can see the names and you can see it any time. So you don't try to memorize it. You don't try to get it in your head. So it is better this way and be able to say, and this is the first akusala cheta, this is say first kama jalasa cheta, and so on. So we will come to that later, maybe not today. So two kinds of truth: conventional truth and ultimate truth. And ultimate truth is treated in the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Now, even in outside world, something comparable to the conventional truth and ultimate truth can be found, especially with scientists. So, water is called water by us, by ordinary people, but by chemists, or when they are doing their laboratory work, they will say H2O. So, when we say water, then we are speaking on the conventional level, and when we say H2O, we are speaking on the ultimate level, something like that. So, in the same way, when we say a man or a woman, and we are using the conventional terms, but when we say five aggregates, or nama and rupa, mind and matter, then we are using ultimate terms. And according to Abhidhamma, there are four kinds of ultimate truth. The first one is called citta, C-I-T-T-A, and it is translated as consciousness. Now, please do not be afraid of Pali words. Remember them as many as you can. And the more you remember, the better you will understand. Because when you are studying something of a technical nature, you cannot avoid the technical terms altogether. And sometimes it is better to keep the original word than use the translation, because translations, most translations are not really accurate. But we cannot, since we cannot find a better word, we have to be satisfied with the word we are using. So consciousness is also an example of that. We'll see. So what is consciousness? What is citta? Let me use the Pali word. What is citta? Now, citta is defined as that which knows the object. The literal definition of the word citta is something which knows the object. And which knows the object really means which is aware of the object. So, citta is the awareness of the object. And awareness here means just a pure awareness. Not like awareness we are familiar with when we meditate. So, when giving instructions on meditation, the teacher say, be aware of your breath, be aware of your activities. But that awareness is not pure awareness, but awareness plus mindfulness. But here, the pure awareness is meant. pure awareness of the object. So, when you sit here, and you'll be looking forward, but you're aware of something on your side. So something like that. The awareness of the object, the pure awareness. It is compared to clear water. No color, nothing. So pure awareness of the object. And that is what we call citta in Abhidhamma. And this awareness of the object is never without an object. We have to emphasize this because even in the ancient times, there were people who thought that consciousness or citta could be without an object. But according to the teachings of Abhidhamma, citta cannot be without an object. It must have an object, and it depends on the object to arise. So citta must always have an object. So we cannot say, just let your mind be alone without any object. Or we may say, keep your mind blank. But we think we can keep our minds blank. But actually, mind or consciousness cannot be without an object. But that object may sometimes be an obscure object, not a vivid object. So sometimes it may be the obscure object, and most of the time it will be a vivid object. But we need an object for the citta to arise. So citta always needs an object. That is one thing. And citta is always with us. We are never without citta as long as we are alive. In fact, this citta arises and then disappears, and then another citta arises and disappears. And so this arising of citta goes on and on and on. Not only to the end of this life, but also into future lives, until say, we become arahants or Buddhas and gain final liberation. So citta is always with us. We are never without the citta. Now, what when we are asleep? See, sometimes we slept very well, and we had a dreamless sleep. According to Abhidhamma, even when you are fast asleep, there is citta with you. There is consciousness with you. Consciousness or citta does not leave you even when you are fast asleep. Now, when a person is asleep, or sometimes a person does an accident and he is said to be unconscious. So even at such times, his mind is not said to be blank. He has the consciousness or citta, and that citta has some kind of obscure object. It is not objects like visible objects or audible objects, but another kind of object which is not evident, but still that is an object. And so even when we are asleep, even when we are unconscious, there is citta going on in our mind, and that citta has a kind of object which is not the vivid object. So citta is always with us. Therefore, the word consciousness is not a satisfactory translation for the word citta, because when we say consciousness, we imply be knowing something. And we do not call a person conscious when he is asleep. when he has fainted. But still, according to Abhidhamma, there is Jada with him. So Jada could be, I don't know, consciousness, but it is the nearest translation to the word Jada, and so we accept consciousness as the translation of Jada. But when we use consciousness in the context of Abhidhamma, we must understand that it means Jada, and it means awareness of the object, and this Jada can be with us all, is with us all the time, and it cannot be without an object at any given time. Now, synonyms of Jada. In Pali, even in the Abhidhamma books, many explanations are given in synonyms. Actually, explanations given in the Abhidhamma are something like a list of synonyms. And these synonyms are used in different contexts. And so, Chaita has some synonyms, and these synonyms are used in the Abhidhamma books as well as in sutras. So we need to understand some synonyms of it, so that we, when we come across these words, we understand that it is nothing but Chaita. So the word most frequently used for as a synonym for Chaita is Vijnana, V-I-N-N-A-N-A. V-I-N-N-A-N-A. So the two N's close together must have a tilde above them. So Vijnana. Vijnana is a synonym for Chaita. So they are interchangeable. In some place, the word Vijnana will be used, and in another place, the word Chaita will be used. But whenever we find the word Chaita or Vijnana, we have to understand that they mean the same thing. Another synonym for Chaita is Mana or Mano, M-A-N-A or M-A-N-O. So Mano or Mana, Vijnana and Chaita are synonyms, and they mean the same thing, awareness of the object or consciousness. Now, there is a word in Pali which is Nama, N-A-M-A. Nama is not really synonymous with Chaita, although Chaita is Nama. Now we say Nama, Rupa, mind and matter. So Nama is translated as mind, and Rupa is translated as matter, mind and matter. Now, Nama is not exactly synonymous with Chaita. Nama has a wider connotation, a wider application than the word Chaita, because we'll come to the mental factors, Chittisikas. Chittisikas are also Nama. So when we say Nama, we mean Chaita and Chittisikas, two things. What we call mind is composed of two things, Chaita and then Chittisika. You'll find the word down a little down in the notes, Chaitasika, mental factors, number two. So, mind is composed of Chaita and Chaitasika. So, the combination of Chaita and Chaitasika we call Nama. So, the word Nama is not exactly synonymous with Chaita, although Chaita is a part of Nama. And these are nama, chaita, and vijnana are all translated as consciousness, because we have no other English word. And the chaita is said to be of 89 or 121 types, or in the Abhidhamma Pitaka, 89 or 121 types of chaita are recognized. So there are 89 types of chaitas, so or 121 types of chaitas. And the details will be in the next two talks. Or look at the chart and you'll see 121, let's say, dots there. So each one represents one chaita. So there are said to be 89 chaitas or 121 chaitas. Because chaitas differ whether it is accompanied by a pleasurable feeling or displeasurable feeling, or whether it is accompanied by understanding or not, or whether it is prompted or not, and so on. We'll come to them in the next lecture. So chaita is said to be of 89 types or 121 types. And all these chaitas are described and explained in the first book of Abhidhamma, actually. And in the manual of Abhidhamma, the book we are using as a reference book, the first chapter deals with the chaitas, 121 types of chaitas. Now, the second ultimate truth is chaitasikas. Now, we have one more synonym for chaita here, that is chaita, C-E-T-A. So chaita also means chaita. So chaitasika means those which are yoked in chaita or which are yoked on chaita. It really means those which are associated with chaita, which arise together with chaita, depending on chaita for their arising. Now, craving is a chaitasika. Anger is a chaitasika. Pride is a chaitasika. Mindfulness is a chaitasika. Wisdom or understanding is a chaitasika. So there are many chaitasikas. They are states of mind. And they accompany different types of chaitas. And when a chaita comes into combination with certain number of chaitasikas, then, and if those chaitasikas are of good quality, good nature, then that chaita is called a good chaita or a beautiful chaita. When a chaita is accompanied by or associated with unwholesome or bad chaitasikas, then it is called an unwholesome chaita or bad chaita. So chaitasikas are like color put in water. Water has no color, so water is like chaita. But we put some color in the water and say there is say red water in the glass or blue water in the glass or something like that. So the color put into water, I mean, chaitasikas are compared to color put into water. So they color the chaitas. That is why chaitas came to be 89 or 121, because they are accompanied by different mental factors or chaitasikas. So they are called, chaitasikas are called mental factors or mental concomitants. And they are different states of mind, and they always accompany chaita. Without the chaita, they cannot arise. And in order for anything to be a chaitasika, it must possess four characteristics. So one is arising together with chaita. A chaitasika must arise together at the same moment with chaita. So when the chaita arises, chaitasika must also arise. And number two, perishing together with chaita. It must disappear with chaita. So they have the same lifespan, only three sub-moments. So Jitasika must perish or disappear together with, or at the same time as Chaita. And Jitasika must have identical object with Chaita. Because Chaita and Jitasika arise together, they cannot take different objects. Say Chaita taking one object and Jitasika taking a different another object. That cannot be. So Chaita and Jitasika must have the same object, must take the same object. So Jitasika takes the object that is taken by the Chaita. So Jitasika must have an identical object with Chaita. And Jitasika must have a common base with Chaita. Base here means sensitivities in the sense organs, like sensitivity in the eye, sensitivity in the ear, and so on, without which we cannot have seeing consciousness or hearing consciousness, and so on. So they are called base in Pali Vattu. So a Chaitasika must have the same base as the Chaita. Or in other words, Chaitasika must have a common base with Chaita. Base here means sensitivities in the sense organs, like sensitivity in the eye, sensitivity in the ear, and so on, without which we cannot have seeing consciousness or hearing consciousness, and so on. So they are called base in Pali Vattu. So a Chaitasika must have the same base as the Chaita. Or in other words, Chaitasika must depend upon the base, which is the base of Chaita. So in fact, Chaita and Chaitasika must have the same base. That means when we see something and we have the seeing consciousness, and together with seeing consciousness, some Chaitasikas arise. So these Chaitasikas, together with the seeing consciousness, must arise together, perish together, must have the same object, and must have the same base. Here, the sensitivity of the eye. So these are the four characteristics of Chaitasika, and anything which is to be called Chaitasika must possess these four characteristics. And there are 52 Chaitasikas recognized in Abhidhamma. And we will study Chaitasikas in lecture number 5. And they are treated in the second chapter of the manual. Now, Chaita and Chaitasika arise together. And when they arise together, when they are existent in our minds, we call it as mind. So what we call mind is just Chaita and Chaitasika together. And it is very difficult for us ordinary people to really see or to really know all these different types of Chaitas. And Chaitas and Chaitasikas, and to really know this is one, this is Chaita, and this is Chaitasika, this is another Chaitasika, this is another Chaitasika, because it's very difficult. Although during Vipassana meditation, we may be able to experience some of these Chaitasikas. In the Milinda Panya, at the questions of King Milinda, it is a dialogue between a king and a Buddhist monk. And in that, the Venerable Nagasena, the name of the monk was Nagasena. Nagasena said, Buddha did a very difficult thing, and that is to define exactly which is Chaita and which this is Chaita, this is contact, this is feeling, this is perception, and so on. Among the things that arise together and that takes the same object. it is maybe more difficult than someone picking a water from the ocean and then tasting it and telling that this is water from one river and this is water from another river. So it is easier for a man to be able to say differentiate different waters from different rivers than to be able to say this is Cheda and this is one Chetasika, this is another Chetasika, and so on. So Buddha did a very difficult thing when he taught Abhidhamma. But as we learned earlier, that the ultimate truth are those that can be realized by ourselves, that can be experienced by ourselves. They really are. And especially when we pay attention to them, especially when we practice meditation and watch our thoughts. Now the third of the ultimate truth is rupa, and this is matter. Rupa is defined as that which changes when coming into contact with adverse conditions such as cold, heat, thirst, hunger, bite of insects, and so on. So when it is hot, we have one kind of matter, and when it is cold, we have another kind of matter. And when we are hungry, we have one kind of matter, and when we are thirsty, there's another kind of matter, and so on. So what changes when coming into contact with these adverse conditions is called rupa in Pali. And it is conveniently translated as matter in English. And here, change means the obvious and discernible change. Because mind changes much more quickly than matter. Your mind can come and go millions of times in a second. But your body is still there. So mind changes so much more quickly than matter, but it is not so obvious as the change of matter. So here, change means obvious or discernible change, and so only the matter is called rupa and not the cheta or the chetasika. Cheta and chetasika also change, but they are not called rupa. Only that which change, which has the discernible change, is called rupa. So rupa is that which changes, or which is oppressed by change, or oppressed by heat, cold, and so on. So rupa is that which exists in everything. It exists in living beings and outside things as well. So we have a physical body. So that is rupa. But we are a combination of rupa and nama. So we have consciousness of mind and the physical body, matter, together. But a table has no consciousness. It has only matter, and a jug, only matter. So outside things have only matter, while living beings have both mind and matter. So matter exists both in living beings and in outside things. And matter has no ability to cognize. So matter does not know. A table does not know, a jug does not know, a book does not know, although it can make us know. So rupa is that which cannot cognize, which does not know, which is not aware of anything. And there are 28 kinds of matter or material properties recognized in Abhidhamma. So there are 28 material properties taught in the first book of Abhidhamma and also in other books. They are comparable to elements in chemistry. And these 28 material properties are the building blocks of the human beings and also of the outside or inanimate things. So they are comparable to elements in chemistry. So according to chemistry, there are about 100 elements, and everything is made, material thing is not only material things, even the living beings. So everything is made up of some of these elements. Similarly, everything animate and inanimate alike is made up of some of the 28 kinds of material properties. And so they are called material property, or they are called rupa, because they have changed when they come into contact with conditions like heat, cold, hunger, and so on. And rupa or matter is treated in detail in the sixth chapter of the manual, and will be dealing with the matter in the seventh lecture. And the last of the ultimate truth is Nibbana, Sammam Bonam of Buddhism. Is that English? No. It looks like, sounds like Pali. Sammam Bonam of Buddhism. So it is the highest goal of Buddhism. I think it's Latin.
It's Latin.
Yeah?
Buddhism, the goal.
Oh. Highest goal? Oh. Highest truth?
Highest good.
Highest good. Oh. Now, Nibbana is very, very difficult to talk about. Nibbana is defined as that which gets out of the range of craving. Nibbana is composed of ni and let's say vana or vana, V-A-N-A. And here, vana means craving. And ni means no. So no craving really means out of craving, out of attachment or out of craving. That means attachment or craving cannot take nibbana as object. So it is outside the range of the objects of craving. That is why it is called nibbana. That is one meaning of the word nibbana. You may not have heard this meaning. But there's another meaning. What is that? Blowing out?
Burned
something
out.
Like that.
Huh?
Extinction?
Burned
out. Yeah, burn out. That is another meaning. Sometimes the Pali words can be explained in different ways. They're taking, cutting it into a root and a suffix, and then you can explain it many ways. So, Nibbana. However it is defined, Nibbana is the extinction of desire, ill will, delusion, and so on. Extinction of mental defilements. Mental defilements are those like desire, attachment, ill will, delusion, pride, envy, and so on. So, extinction of these mental defilements is what is called Nibbana. And although we call it extinction of desire or ill will or delusion, extinction of mental defilements, we should not take it to be negative. So, many people think that Nibbana is negative, because when Nibbana is described, it is always almost always described in negative terms. But it is like health or peace. So what is health? Absence of
illness.
That's right. So, but health is not negative. It's a positive condition. So peace also. What is peace? Absence of war. So in the same way, what is Nibbana? Absence of desire, ill will, delusion, absence of mental defilements. And also it is explained as absence of suffering or liberation, freedom from suffering. So Nibbana has two aspects actually. Extinction of mental defilements, and also liberation from suffering, or getting out of freedom from suffering. So these two aspects, we will elaborate on it later in lecture 12. And Nibbana is unconditioned. Now, everything in the world is, according to Buddhism, conditioned. Everything is conditioned by some other thing or some other things. So, citta is conditioned, cetasika is conditioned, rupa is conditioned. All these things are conditioned. So they depend on some other thing for their arising. But Nibbana is unconditioned. Nibbana is not caused by anything. Nibbana is just, I don't know whether I can call it a state, because a state may imply existence. Existence may imply arising, then staying for some time and disappearing. But Nibbana is, but it does not exist. It's very difficult to understand. Nibbana is that's why it cannot be adequately described in everyday terms. So Nibbana is something which becomes the object of mind or consciousness at the moment of enlightenment. So what enlightenment means according to Buddhism is direct seeing of Nibbana. So at the moment of enlightenment, a certain kind of consciousness or citta arises in a person, and that citta takes Nibbana as a direct object. So taking Nibbana as object, that consciousness eradicates mental defilement. So Nibbana is not the result of anything. We may say that realization of Nibbana is a result of meditation, but Nibbana itself is not the result of meditation. It is there all the time. Let's say all the time, or it is like Panyadi, timeless. So we cannot say Nibbana was in the past or now existing, or it will be in the future. But Nibbana is like a Panyadi. So Nibbana is not the result of anything, not the result of meditation, or not the result of the practice of Noble Eightfold Path. But the realization of Nibbana is the result of the Noble Eightfold, the practice of Vipassana meditation. So Nibbana cannot be adequately described in everyday terms, because we have no words to describe it. It is not a thing, not a state, not a condition, so we have no word. But it is, and it has a characteristic of peace, peacefulness or peace. And it is the extinction of mental defilements and the extinction of suffering. Extinction of suffering really means extinction of mind and matter. So final passing away. Now, what about the Four Noble Truths? Everybody who has read a little about Buddhism is familiar with the Four Noble Truths. Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. Are they outside of ultimate truth, or are they included in ultimate truth? So the Four Noble Truths are included in ultimate truth, or they belong to the ultimate truth. Now, what is the first noble truth of what is the first noble truth? The noble truth of suffering. And the noble truth of suffering really means the mundane, chetas, chetasikas, and rupa. So that is the noble truth of suffering, actually. So mundane chetas, chetasikas, and rupas belong to ultimate truth. It is very strange that supramundane cheta, which is the best of the cheta, is outside of all four noble truths. So supramundane cheta does not belong to truth of suffering, or origin of suffering, or cessation of suffering, or even to the path leading to the cessation of suffering. That means the cheta alone, but the chetasikas accompanying that cheta belong to the fourth noble truth. We'll come to that. So the first noble truth is nothing but mundane chetas, chetasikas, and rupa. So they are ultimate truth. Now the second noble truth, the noble truth of origin of suffering, the noble truth of origin of suffering is craving. Craving is one of the 52 chetasikas. In Pali it is tanha or loba, L-O-B-H-A. So, since it is a mental factor, it is a chetasika, it belongs to ultimate truth. And then the third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the third noble truth is nothing but nibbana. And nibbana is one of the ultimate truths. And the fourth noble truth, the practice leading to the cessation of suffering, is the Noble Eightfold Path. And what is Noble Eightfold Path? The eight factors, right understanding, right thought, and so on. So these eight factors are actually the eight mental factors. So when we study the 52 mental factors, we will find them. So the Noble Eightfold Path, or the fourth noble truth, also belongs to the ultimate truth. So the four noble truths, all the four noble truths belong to ultimate truth, one or the other of the ultimate truths. So to repeat, the first noble truth is what? Mundane chetas, chetasikas, and rupa. And the second noble truth is craving, which is a chetasika. The third noble truth is nibbana itself. And the fourth noble truth is, again, the combination or group of eight mental factors, beginning with right understanding or wisdom. So they belong to the ultimate truth. So today we study two kinds of truth, the conventional truth and ultimate truth, and four kinds of ultimate truth that are treated or that are taught in Abhidhamma. And in coming talks or coming studies, we'll go into some details about concerning these four ultimate truths. Okay. And if you have questions, yes.
I lost you on the last points.
Yeah.
I got that suffering is actually mundane. And then I lost you on the part that the supramundane chetas are outside of the ultimate truth.
Outside of, not ultimate truth, outside of four noble truths. Now, Abhidhamma is very precise and strict. So, cheta that arises at the moment of enlightenment, and they are called path consciousness and fruition consciousness. And when we say supramundane cheta, we mean cheta only, and not the chetasikas accompanying it. And the supramundane is out of the reach of craving. Craving cannot take supramundane as object. So it is out of the reach of the craving. And it does not belong to the first noble truth, because first noble truth concerns with mundane things, mundane chetas, chetasika, and rupas. And it is not second noble truth, because second noble truth is craving. And it is not the third noble truth, because third noble truth is nibbana. And the cheta, the supramundane cheta, is not the fourth noble truth, because the fourth noble truth is the group of chetasikas accompanying that cheta. So cheta itself is not, or cheta itself is out of the four noble truths, but the chetasikas accompanying that cheta belong to the fourth noble truth. Yes.
What is the ground of cheetah? From what does cheetah arise? I mean, it has an object in order to arise, I know that.
Yes.
What is the ground from which it arises?
We cannot say where cheetah comes from or where cheetah is stored. But when there are conditions for cheetah to arise, it just arises. So it is like, say, when you put the fuel and the magnifying glass and sun's rays together, there is fire. So we cannot say that fire is contained in the fuel or in the rays of the sun or whatever. But when these things come together, then there is fire. So in the same way, when the conditions for it to arise come together, then cheta arises. And Buddha said, in Pali, chakkhuncha bhateja rupeja upajati chakkhuvijnana, seeing consciousness arises depending on the eye, that means sensitivity in the eye, and on the visible object. So the eye and the visible object are the conditions for seeing consciousness to arise. So when these two come together, it just arises. When they are not together, then it will not arise. So we cannot say that it is the real place of cheta. Although we say that the sensitivity, eye sensitivity, is the base for eye consciousness or seeing consciousness and so on. Yes. And that moment is only one very brief moment. And that is really a moment of cheta. Cheta together with accompanying chetasikas. And the moment of enlightenment is very brief. So brief that it's almost imperceptible. But the experience is so overwhelming that a person who has really experienced enlightenment cannot miss it. Because nibbana, no other types of consciousness can take nibbana as direct object. Only the third consciousness, or only at the moment of enlightenment can consciousness take nibbana as object. And nibbana, so it is so new to it. The nibbana has never been taken as an object by the consciousness. So it is very overwhelming at the moment of realization of truth or enlightenment. But it lasts only for one brief moment.
Then what becomes succeeding chitta after that brief moment?
Any chitta after arising disappears. So that we call path consciousness. Path consciousness arises and disappears. And then it is followed by two or three moments of another kind of jhana, or we call it fruition consciousness. So jhana has only a lifespan of one very brief moment. Another jhana of the same kind may arise, but not in this context, in other contexts. But a jhana can last only for a very brief moment. It is said in the books that in the twinkling of an eye, or in the snapping of a finger, maybe billions of thought moments can come and go. It is almost unbelievable. But we have come into computer age, and so there is some similarity between these. A computer can solve millions of problems in a second, they said. Now they are using the expression nanosecond or something like that. not 1 second, a millionth of a second or a billionth of a second. So if a computer can solve a million problems in less than a second, the mind can do it also. Because in order to solve a problem, the computer must go through all the information given to it. It must go through all the stages and before it comes to conclusion. And that would take very long, but when you press a key, then the answer is already there on the screen. So it takes no time at all to solve any problem. It looks like it, but actually it must go through all these steps in order to reach the decision, or in order to be able to give the answer. So in the same way, mind works very fast. And how fast, nobody really knows except the Buddha. So the lifespan of a chitta is very brief. And just one moment and then disappears. Then another chitta follows, another chitta follows. And so one chitta is followed by another, until, say, we become arahants or Buddhas and gain final extinction or liberation. Yes?
I think you said that ultimate truth is different for each person.
No, but you know, according to the second reason for being a good thing or correct thing, ultimate truth is that which can be realized by oneself, which can be experienced by oneself. So, according to that the explanation, the ultimate truth will become ultimate truth for you only when you experience it. But ultimate truth is always ultimate truth. But it will become ultimate for you or to you only when you experience it. See, San Francisco is always here. But until you come here, you have not really experienced San Francisco. You have not really known San Francisco. So until you come to this city, you do not, San Francisco is not real for you, something like that.
So between two different people that might be sitting together,
yeah,
their perception of ultimate truth is different, because it only,
that's right,
as it meets themselves.
Yes,
their particular combination.
Right, because different people have different capabilities. I mean, mental capabilities, and so their experience may be different. That's right, yes. Yes.
And then something wrong, for example, the ultimate truth.
Pardon?
Then like a mirage.
Mirage?
What's the word?
Oh, mirage. Mirage does not exist at all. It looks like when we see it from a distance, but when we reach that place, there is no mirage. I mean, no water. Mirage looks like water. Because mirage really means water, so it doesn't really exist. It looks like water.
It doesn't exist as water, it exists as a mirage.
That's right, yeah.
It exists as a mirage, but not as water.
That's right.
If you think it's water, then it's not.
It's not, right.
But your eye sees that image, but when you say water, then that's not what it is.
You know it's not
but when we see mirage, we think it's water. It looks like water, and that is why it is in Pali it is called miga dhanhiga. Miga dhanhiga means deer thirst or something like that. The cattle see mirage from a distance and they thought it is water, and so they follow this mirage, and they never reach that place, and they die of thirst.
So for human beings, you can think hope of this thing, they exist
from the mirage, and knows
it's a mirage, it's not water.
Yeah, if mirage is true on the conventional level, that's right. And I don't know whether what you see as mirage is something really can be seen. I think it is. It can be seen. We see. So the visible data in what we call mirage is ultimate truth, but the mirage itself is not. Yeah. Because if it can be seen, then it is the visible datum, which is one of the 28 material properties. It is not our imagination. See, we see something there, and that visible datum or visible data are ultimate truth. But the mirage is. Just appearance. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have the notes for the lecture for next week, and for those of you who haven't signed up, you can see me.
Datum or visible data are ultimate truth, but the mirage is just appearance. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I have the notes for the lecture for next week, and for those of you who haven't signed up, you can see me.